As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe in Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's Coolest Conversations podcast time, presented by Hard Rock and Little Stephen's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and thanks for listening. Please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. My guest this time around is Chris Payne, one of the two guitarists in the New York City-based band The Midnight Callers. Their album Red Letter Glow is available from Gem Records, and it features our recent coolest song in the world, 41 Miles to Roscoe. Let's give some of that a listen now, and then I'll be back with Chris on the line for your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage. You got the Mighty Manfred here in Little Stephen's Underground Garage, and it's time for today's Coolest Conversations. Joining me is Chris Payne, one of the two guitarists in the New York City band The Midnight Callers. Their new album, Red Letter Glow, is out Friday, October the 23rd, and available from Gem Records, and it features our recent coolest song in the world, 41 Miles to Roscoe. How are you, Chris?
I'm doing well. How are you, Manfred?
I'm hanging in there, and I'm very happy to be chatting with you today, man, I got to say. And, you know, I read that you guys are from New York City. Is that spread all over the area, or are you guys, like, mainly in Brooklyn? Where exactly around the city are you guys based?
Yeah, so our headquarters is actually right in the music building, right in the middle near the Port Authority there on, like, 38th Street. But, I mean, in terms of us, we're all spread out. I live in Astoria, Queens, with the drummer also lives here. Martin, our guitar player, he lives out in the Bronx, as well as Marley, our bass player. So we're all spread out, but then we kind of get together for rehearsals and pull together. And then we're from, in terms of where we're from, it's literally everywhere across the globe, funny enough.
Well, first let me ask, though, since you are there in the New York City area, all you guys are, and that was such a hot spot a few months ago with the virus, how have your family and friends been doing?
Knock on wood, everyone's been doing really well. I mean, you know, obviously, like you said, it was kind of a crazy time, you know, especially during the real peak stuff in April. And, you know, it's kind of scary and confusing. Even for us, you know, it kind of meant we had to take a hiatus from rehearsing and playing and, you know, just kind of, you know, being together, which kind of sucks not seeing your buddies. But then, yeah, luckily things have really kind of turned around here. I think everyone's kind of gotten the message up here and is really, you know, taking care of each other, wearing the mask, doing the social distancing thing. And, you know, now we're back in the studio rehearsing. So luckily things are definitely turned around here and kind of getting a, you know, a sense of normalcy. I won't say it's full normalcy, but at least we're, you know, getting back on schedule.
Well, good. And so you mentioned you guys being from all over the world, but did the band actually form there in New York?
Yeah, so we formed in New York, myself and Julian Petrino, our drummer. We were in a band together previously, and, you know, it was kind of like a mod rock 60s style thing, which probably would work out for the Underground Garage as well. But we were in that for a while, and then I started writing songs on the side that just weren't really jiving with the specific kind of like tight genre that we were playing. So then, you know, I just kind of shared him some demos, and he was like, These are pretty good. Like, we should just record it for giggles. So then we did that on, you know, unfortunately the band that we were in kind of dissolved. So then he's like, yeah, all right, let's roll with this some more. So then we brought on Martin Stubbs, our lead guitarist, and Marley, our bass player, and just kind of rolled from there. And so, yeah, we just, you know, we formed right here in the city. We've been kind of, you know, digging it out for the past couple of years now.
What was the name of that earlier band?
So the earlier band was called London Egg. They were, again, very 60s, like, mod rock focused, mm-hmm. definitely like a tip to the cap to like early Who stuff for sure.
And as the Midnight Callers, then you've been together like maybe 2 years or how long?
Yeah, like two and a half years. I mean, we originally, at first we kind of made up the name Chris Payne and Letter Train. Was kind of like, you know, we were trying to do like a Tom Petty type thing, you know, with just like a name and then a band name. So like, it didn't matter who was in the group kind of thing. And then once we all got together and we started like realizing that, look, we're all contributing ideas. We're all writing together. We're all, you know, kind of really a band. It's not like it was my side project anymore. We said, all right, we need to settle on a name. So then we kind of threw the weeds, got through the Midnight Callers.
Oh, it is a cool name. My notes say that Kurt Ryle, the Gripweeds, produced the album. But now my understanding is that it was recorded in Boston at like your parents' house. Is that right?
Yeah, bless my parents. But when we, you know, decided that we wanted to like put everything down and really put together an album, you know, money was a little tight. So we were like, all right, we, you know, we think we know it enough. You know, we were soon proven wrong by Kurt when he got the files and said, what is this? But we thought we knew enough to record it ourselves. So we kind of said, all right, well, what do you need? You know, we need a, you know, big ceilings for a big drum sound. Where can we do that? And none of us could do that in our apartments, or there wasn't a studio we could really rent out in the city. And I said, I think my parents, they got pretty high ceilings. Let me give them a call and see what they'll do. So I gave them a call and said, like, look, we'll bring you a bottle of wine and some earplugs if you just let us like take over your living room for, you know, a weekend or so. So, you know, again, bless them. They took the deal. They got the bottle of wine and probably drank all of it and shoved the earplugs in and then let us kind of track. And so we tracked everything at their house, you know, in terms of drums, bass and guitar, did everything there. And then when we kind of, you know, had the bass tracks down, we kind of said, well, you know, vocally, that's kind of something that needs to be done by a professional. And we were kind of clueless in terms of, you know, we wanted harmonies in there. We had a kind of an idea of what the harmonies are going to be like, but we were like, we really need to dial these in to put something forward that's like really good. Mm-hmm. And because I had worked with Kurt in our old band, London Egg, I just shot him a text and was like, hey, you know, I don't know, you know, if you're open to this, you know, we'd like some direction here. We think we need direction now. So then luckily House of Vibes was open in New Jersey and we kind of ran with it from there.
Very cool. So about mom and dad here for a moment, very cool that you were let you come up there and they were good with the bottle of vino. Oh, by the way, what kind of wine was it? What was their preference?
They like Decoy Cab Sav. So we got them a couple bottles of that.
Okay. So it wasn't Mad Dog 2020. I mean, you guys are going much more top shelf then.
Oh, well, we had to for the torture we were going to put them through.
So mom and dad, very supportive of your music career overall, then, I'm imagining.
Yeah, you know, it was their, I think, a rare set of parents. They're, you know, they weren't like musicians per se. My dad played guitar, but he wasn't like playing out or anything like that. My mom was a violinist way back in the day, but hasn't done it in recent times. And so they've always been kind of supportive of us though. Like, you know, my brother and I both got into guitar and playing in bands in high school. And, you know, we'd invite all our friends over and, you know, we had a drum kit downstairs and just kind of would bang it out and probably turn it up way too loud. And even little things, like I remember when I was a kid, you know, we would plug our mic, and I think like every young kid does this. You take your mic, you plug it into like a guitar amp, and you try to sing through that, and it's never loud enough. It doesn't sound right. You're like, you know, I think we need like a PA or something. So I remember telling my dad, like, hey, like, we're plugging into the guitar amplifier. It's not really working. Like, I don't know what to do. And then like the next day, he's like, all right, cool. Let's go to Guitar Center. Let's go pick up a cheap PA. So drove us down there and did it. So they've always been supportive and just kind of, you know, whatever we needed and wherever they could help us, that's what they did. So, and then when it came to this, it's funny, that was, you know, I was 13 years old, he bought the PA. And then now, you know, I was 28 at the time when we were tracking. And I was like, hey, like, I still need your house to rehearse. Thanks. They were cool with it.
Oh, really, Nate? That is great. So you were talking about reaching out to Kurt specifically when mm-hmm. you were working on the vocals. Is that right?
Yes.
That kind of ties into one of the things I wanted to ask you about, because a lot of these backing vocals on the record with the songs, I think, really cool, you know, really give a little extra oomph. The first song that comes to mind is like State of Me, especially Do We Need It? But throughout, really, what did Kurt offer in the way? I mean, was he arranging the vocals, or was it just a matter of recording the vocals? What was it that he was especially helpful with?
I mean, Kurt, as I'm sure you know, has just a wealth of knowledge. And so he was kind of like the, like we would, as I would joke, like we put it, you know, we'd put the harmony in kind of like simple, stupid terms. And then he'd really kind of take whatever our ideas were and kind of build it out from there. So like you mentioned State of Me, I remember, you know, being like, I kind of have an idea for like a call and response. I don't know how we're going to do it. And he was just like, okay, here's how it should sound. And he would kind of go, you know, sometimes he'd be that direct, or like, here's what I'm hearing. And he'd even sing it on with us, because he was like, maybe there's a harmony we weren't really hearing. He's like, I think it needs just this one more here. And he would do it, which was great. I mean, anytime I can have Kurt sing on one of our albums, you do it kind of thing. And then even for like a Do We Need It, that was something where we were like, look, we're really looking for this kind of ballad of El Goodo, like big star backing vocal. And like, I don't know how to do it though. And then Kurt would be like, okay, let me figure it out. So he was definitely like, you know, the interpreter and kind of the professor. And we were just sitting there taking notes as he would like kind of put forward some ideas. So he really, like I said, I don't think the background vocals would be nearly on the level, or even the vocals overall wouldn't be nearly on the level if it weren't for Kurt kind of like, you know, taking the lead there and, you know, producing it with us.
So the tune Little Steven picked as a coolest song in the world is the album's opening track, 41 Miles to Roscoe. Did you and fellow guitarist Martin Stubbs write that?
Yeah, we both, kind of most of the album was kind of Martin and I, and I always caveat with not to the degree of excellency, but like we kind of tried to do the Lennon and McCartney thing, you know, where we would get together in our rehearsal space. It'd just be the two of us kind of either with acoustics or just plugged into our amps and kind of do the face-to-face. We got to hash this song out. And, you know, yeah. 41 Miles to Roscoe is a similar situation where, you know, I had come in with just the idea of it. You know, I kind of had little bits and bobs of like the chorus, and like we kind of fleshed it out from there. And then I remember we cut a quick demo of it just on like GarageBand, and we used like, you know, I call them robo drums, you know, just to get a beat down and keep it on time. And our drummer Julian was actually back home visiting France, and when we sent it to him, he just kind of texted us. He's like, oh, we've got like, Just send me the hard files. I'll take care of this. I hate these robo drums. I can do it. And then he literally, I mean, if you listen to the demo that he cut with the actual drums, it's very close to the original. So it was, you know, a pretty quick turnaround. But yeah, Martin and I kind of hashed it out face to face, sent it to Julian, and it kind of took off from there.
So the way it came out is pretty much the way you initially envisioned it then.
Yeah. I mean, obviously much better because, you know, Julian, especially as a rhythm section, like he comes up with some ideas. I mean, just that big kind of cracking drum intro there, that's all Julian, where he said, you know, I just want to like snap people into it almost. I said, go for it. And so
what was the inspiration for the lyric side of it?
Lyrically, I mean, so funny enough, I was, my wife, she had gone back to school, in upstate New York, getting to be a veterinary technician. And as I was driving up to visit her, I just happened to glance at, you know, the GPS, and I knew that the exit I was going to be taking was Roscoe, New York, which is kind of that's like the, you know, the milestone in that drive where I knew like, okay, as soon as I get to Roscoe, it's another 10 minutes and I'll be there. So, I glanced over at the GPS and it said, you know, Roscoe exit 41 miles. And I just said, all right, cool. 41 miles to Roscoe. And it just kind of, I was like, oh, that flows off a little bit. And then I was like, well, I can't write a song about, you know, the husband going to drive to see his wife at veterinary technician school. That's not as fun. So, I kind of took that phrase and I just kind of built this story around it of, in my head, kind of a guy who's, you know, he's going to like, you know, get back someone he's loved, and maybe he passed up on that love because, like, you know, he was just a young buck at the time and didn't realize what he had. So that's kind of where the lyrics starts pouring out from there.
Very cool. Ever heard the Edwin Starr song 25 Miles?
I have, yeah.
yeah. Well, that's great. I like those songs a lot, you know, where this puts that sort of the location in mind, you know, the anticipation of getting there, getting home, and everything that entails. And then, you know, sort of the twist here of having taken a wrong exit, even, you know, not have paid attention to that and reached the destination that you should have been to.
A countdown, so to speak.
Right. So you mentioned how you guys typically work together. But yeah, so that's kind of the process then. You and Martin, kind of meeting the practice space and sort of coming up with an initial idea and then taking it to the rest of the guys later on?
Yeah, that's pretty much how pretty much the entire album, aside from maybe like one or two songs where like, you know, maybe Martin might have just sent me a demo and I was like, okay, well, I can't add anything to that, you know, aside from maybe some words, but like, that's great. So let's just roll with it. But yeah, for most of the album, it was Martin and I, you know, kind of listening to a little bit of everything. Like I've been joking, calling our album Millennial Rock, because like, you know, I've been exposed just being a kid, you know, you would put your iPod on shuffle when you were going to school or something and you'd hear like, you know, I'd hear a Raconteur song followed by a Beatles tune. And then, you know, we'd jump over to Buddy Holly or something. Just so it, you know, we kind of took all these influences. So we'd be like, oh, cool. Like, hey, I'm kind of into, you know, like I was listening to the Mac a lot writing this. I was like, hey, I really like this album. And like, you know, I'd play a song for Martin. He'd be like, cool, let's try to write that. And that's how we, you know, we would, you know, kind of sputter out a song like Return the Favor or something like that.
Well, there are like 10 songs on the album, but what's not on there, or maybe it's a bonus track, let me know, is this cover of the Bill Withers tune that you made a video for, the track Use Me. So first of all, why did you guys cover that tune?
Well, I mean, again, sadly, you know, we lost Bill during, I don't think it was because of COVID, but it was during the pandemic, and you know, maybe didn't receive as much news coverage as it should, because, you know, he's obviously a legend. So, we were obviously kind of all sitting at home a little bored during the pandemic. And when that happened, especially, it really bummed us out. So Martin kind of came up with the idea. He goes, I think we should do something to cover Use Me. I don't want to make it cheesy or anything like that. I don't want to do some note for note thing or acoustic. He's like, I think we should just do a Midnight Caller song, but, you know, cover Bill Withers. And so he really, you know, took the bull by the horns, and, you know, he sent me a rough arrangement of it. And I was like, cool, let's run with it. So we all kind of did our own parts as best as we could in our homes, in our apartments, trying to record everything together. And then when Marty heard the cover, he said, look, this is a good cover. You should probably tack this off, at least as a bonus track on the end of the album. So we kind of, you know, thankful for Marty for kind of doing that, because, you know, we've definitely gotten some good feedback on the cover.
Okay, so it is available as a bonus track with the album then?
Yes, I believe it's like out as kind of like a bonus track. If you pre-order our album, you actually get Use Me and Roscoe, the single, as like the bonus tracks for, you know, thanking you for downloading or pre-ordering the entire album.
I see. And so you made a video for the Bill Withers tune. Which cut off the album is going to get a video?
So we're obviously going to be working on 41 Miles to Roscoe. That video is almost wrapped up. And then from there, once that's wrapped up, we'll do our classic democratic process. Like, all right, what do you think the next song will be? And I'm sure Marty from Gem will have a say in that. But then we're kind of just flying by the seat of our pants. Luckily, we have a lot of time, you know, at home to think about these things and work on it.
All right. Well, it's going to be Hipster Girl, by the way. You're going to make
Hipster
that
Girl? Decision. All right.
It's going to be Hipster Girl.
I'll take your vote as that. Your vote counts as two, so I'll bring that in.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And well, I want to talk about that song in a moment, but first, I saw that Gem Records released Gem Records Celebrates John Lennon, and you and other artists, or shall I say, jewels in the Gem Recording crown, are on it. And you do several tracks on there. You do a version of the Beatles tune, It Won't Be Long. And then you do that that John Lennon thing, that, you know, Child of Nature, Jealous Guy. Tell me, why did you choose those songs?
Yeah, so I'll start with It Won't Be Long. You know, Marty had reached out to us, and he kind of put forth this idea that, you know, we should do something for the, you know, the 40th anniversary, sadly, of John's death, but also, you know, his 80th birthday. It was a big, you know, big milestone. So he came up with this concept. He said, just kind of like kick around some Lennon song ideas. And when it came to It Won't Be Long, we were actually, the band was actually doing a photo shoot for the album cover, and we were kind of just listening to Beatles tunes, and I put on, you know, Meet the Beatles. It's the first track, you know, and we kind of said, wow, like, you know, for what, you know, for the time that it was, this is a pretty kicking song. It just, you know, maybe if we added some guitars on it, we could really give it a boost. And again, kind of here's where the map comes into the play again, where I was like, well, I've always loved My Sharona just because it comes with these big drums right in the beginning, you know? So I kind of told Julian, I said, can you do something like that? Obviously don't rip off My Sharona, but like, you know, can we get that vibe right from the beginning? I think, you know, what if the Beatles were playing this in the 70s and the Mac was the backing band, was kind of my thought going into it. Mm-hmm. And so, we just thought it was, you know, it's the funny thing about the early Beatles sometimes, at least I think, is that they, you know, they're just a killer rock and roll band, and I don't think they get enough credit as a killer rock and roll band, especially in those early tracks, you know what I mean? So we wanted to kind of highlight that with It Won't Be Long, and then to kind of balance it out, because, you know, we love the fast, hard, pumping rock and roll stuff, but then we also like all of the, you know, the Beatles tunes and some of their more, you know, ballad numbers. And Martin is actually a huge solo Beatles fan, more than he is even a Beatles fan. He kind of discovered the Beatles later in life. So he goes, you know what song like is really cool? And just like, he was kind of like, I think we could put our little spin on it, is Jealous Guy. And, you know, we started talking, and then Martin came up with this idea of doing like this real like Southern rock soul ballad, was kind of the goal going into the studio. Mm-hmm. And just kind of, you know, really amplifying some things, adding a 12 string in the choruses to kind of make it jangle a bit. Yeah. And then get those beautiful harmonies on the back of the chorus, which is actually, I have to mention, is actually Martin's mother and his two sisters are singing backgrounds on that song. So the joke is we're calling them the call girls. So it was really cool. He actually went to his family home in Pennsylvania and recorded them singing that. So it's all, you know, keeping it all in the family there. And then Marty from Jem heard the Jealous Guy, at least the demo of it. And he says, you know what you guys got to do? Like, you know, the White Album, you know, re-release or remaster just came out. You know, you guys should cut a version of Child of Nature. And I was aware of it, and I was kind of like, oh, I never thought of that. Maybe we could make it kind of blend in together. So we, Martin and I, again, put our heads together a little bit, and we didn't want to just do Child of Nature the same way we just did Jealous Guy. We thought maybe keep it, you know, acoustic-y demo sounding, but like what would kind of like a Big Star 13 meets Crosby, Stills, and Nash kind of do. So that's where kind of these close harmonies or unison harmonies came into play. And then Martin just does, I think, some of his best work on a 12-string acoustic, picking along with it, and it just kind of flowed from there.
Oh, very cool. So there was a live stream concert in celebration of Lennon's 80th birthday that you guys participated in recently. Who all was involved with that?
Yeah, so it was pretty much everyone on the Jem label. I mean, obviously ourselves, the Gripweeds, the Weaklings, Richard Barone, Jonathan Pushkar, and the Anderson Council were all there, which was, it was kind of nice for us, because again, going back to that weird sense of normalcy, it was cool to play a show and kind of hang out with all the guys and everything and get to see everybody again. And then, we were lucky enough where we actually backed up Jonathan Pushkar for his two tracks. So, it was Starting Over and I Call Your Name. So that was cool to just, again, play some early Beatles tunes mixed with another late Lennon track. Yeah. And then we backed up Richard Barone, who actually came out and sang Jealous Guy with us as well, on his track of Revolution Meets Power to the People. So that was, it was just a fun time to play with all those guys.
Do you guys have any other streaming things upcoming?
Nothing as of yet. We're working on getting the Roscoe video out. That's going to be the next push thing. And then at this point, because things are slowly coming around the corner a little bit, we're working on doing reaching out to some venues and trying to get some live stream concerts coming up.
Okay. Well, I want us to go out with another track off the new album, Red Letter Glow. It's Hipster Girl. Mm-hmm. We mentioned that a couple months ago. So Hipster Girl, is that an unrequited love, or did you receive carnal knowledge?
So yeah, that the basis of Hipster Girl was that actually, was unrequited, which was usually the case, usually the thing in my case. But it was, I was in college. I met a girl who lived in the arts house, and you know, she was pretty cool, and I didn't think I was at the time, and so I kind of, you know, penned that song as an homage to her, as the cool girl or the cool hip, you know, hipster chick that, never came to be, but at least she's immortalized now in the album.
Absolutely. And so you, this kind of followed that song when you were writing it, it follows the same kind of process. You got together with Martin and you guys worked that together.
Yeah. So what was cool about that was, and this is where, again, you know, I love writing with Martin, was I came in with kind of a more straight ahead, like Cheap Trick, you know, just bang it out kind of track. And Martin goes, you know, it'd be cool. Like, what if we add a bit of that like R&B beat behind it and kind of do Cheap Trick Motown thing going on. And so again, called Julian, said, hey, you know, on the demo, can you just do this cool R&B beat? which he loves us for now because he gets exhausted while playing it. But, you know, and when he put that on there, we were like, boom, that's it. Like, that's exactly what we needed. So, again, it was that same thing where I came in with an idea that was, like, pretty good. We thought the hook was pretty good. But then Martin kind of said, I can hear something else here, which, you know, Martin's got a good arrangement here for sure. And then when we brought it into the studio with Kurt, we said, hey, you know, this is, we're going for Cheap Trick Motown. And he just goes, say no more. I know what you want.
Excellent. Well, Chris... thank you so much for talking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure speaking with you. Hope to meet you in person once all this craziness is over.
Well, let's give Hipster Girl a spin. Here's the Midnight Callers off the new album Red Letter Draw in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
There she goes. Where's she going?
All about a hipster girl. That was the Midnight Callers here in Little Steven's Underground Garage off the new album Red Letter Dawn out on Gem Records. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Chris for speaking with me and also to Olivia Callahan for producing our segment. Join me next time around when my guest will be Keith Strang, the guitarist for those long-running purveyors of super rock, the Flesh Tones. Their latest full-length is called Face of the Screaming Werewolf, and we'll talk all about it on your next Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe in Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Don't let it slide, baby, diamond ring.